one instruction with a couple sets of test data, I could figure out what changes that one instruction is making to the state. This, in fact, works so well that I could dump ARM code running in thumb mode. So it essentially could dump data from the area you couldn't data fetch. Turns out this boot ROM had pretty much nothing in it. All the security was done in the ASIC. It was a little like hash function generator, and it uploads the code 8 bytes at a time, runs it through the hash function, and if the hash matches a golden hash you uploaded later, it would enable the DSP on the phone, which would allow the phone to connect to networks, and if you didn't do this, it wouldn't enable the DSP. So carrier locking. Another way to approach these things is, why bother breaking the boot chain at all? Unlocking is a normal function that phones can perform, so let's figure out how the phone is traditionally locked. It has lock state data, which is just like a table with what like MCC and MNC the phone is locked to. And then there are actually unlock codes which you could type in if you knew the right unlock code for the phone. It's salted and it's SHA, just like passwords on Linux systems. And it's checked on every startup. So it's not like you could just set a bit somewhere in the flash to say this phone is now unlocked. You have to have the right code every startup for it to check, and SHA is a one-way function, so you can't do that. 12 digits long. It's 12 digits, 10 to the 12th. That's not that infeasible to brute force. But what Nokia did, they included a 3-digit random salt, and when you type in the 12-digit unlock code, it brute forces the last 3 digits, increasing the key space to 10 to the 15th. Still brute forceable. So GPGPU, the ATI has a stream. I guess it's all open CL now, but back when it was stream and CDA. I bought these two nice ATI 4850 HD cards, $100 for a teraflop. And this thing could calculate 1 billion SHA hashes per second and compare them with the hash and see if it matched. Took about 6 days to unlock one of the phones. Cool in theory, not good enough for the people who contracted me to do this job. They needed something way faster. So I did all the math. We were considering building an FPGA-based supercomputer, which could do 1 trillion SHA hashes per second. And the costs all worked out. So it would have been interesting to do if I didn't find out what I found next. The Blechenbacher exploit, I don't know if I pronounce it right, Blechenbacher, something like that. It's an attack on low exponent RSA. It was in the original iPhone. So iPhone SIM 3, the first software unlock to come out, the paid one, they used this exploit. So I'm very familiar with it. RSA is the ciphertext raised to the third power, mod the modulus. So if the ciphertext raised to the third power is less than the modulus, you can control the bytes that are there. So you can control the first text 2A bytes using iPhone SIM 3. So the first hex 10 bytes are checked, and the last hex 14 bytes are the SHA hash. So I was like, okay, Blechenbacher can't work because I have to control the beginning of the RSA struct. Well, I was wrong. Find C, ciphertext, such that I control the start and the end digits. Start digits is easy. You just take the cube root. The end digits is harder, and I never actually worked out the math completely behind this, but I found a way to brute force it an n time, where n is the number of digits. So that took about 6 milliseconds to do the brute force. And then you have the expansion, a plus b to the third. The a cube term and the b cube term make up the top and the bottom, and the middle is just garbage. So that cost me that job. The rest of this presentation is exploits I tried for and actually succeeded at getting. So start with some iPhone stuff, and we'll get to the PS3 stuff later. iPhone a case study. It's a good example of a basic embedded system. The iPhone, the PSP scene and the iPhone scene, there's a lot of parallels between them. So the iPhone actually has two processors. This is the boot chain on both of them. The left is the application processor, the secure ROM, the low-level bootloader, iBoot, the kernel, and then applications. And each one of those signature checks the next one. On the left, this is the boot chain of the baseband, the phone processor, a boot ROM, a bootloader, and the actual main code for the baseband. So the original iPhone, the iPod Touch, and the 3G are pwned for life. Both exploits, there's a buffer overflow in the boot ROM. So you can upload like a loader. If you've taken apart any IPSWs, it's called IBIS or IBEC. You can upload these loaders, and the loaders have an Apple signature at the end of them. And there's just a buffer overflow in one of the fields. So you make that longer, overwrite right on the stack, and jump into your code. Very easy. And yeah, there's no check. This is the reason these are untethered. There's just no check between the boot ROM and the LLB. How the engineers overlooked this, there's all the code in the boot ROM to do it, they just didn't flip the flag. So yeah, that's where most security vulnerabilities really come from. Other exploits. So then the iPod Touch 2 comes out, and there's... can't do this anymore. They check it. They check it properly. But they load the encrypted code into a hex 24,000 section. But there's no check to make sure the code is 24,000 long, and if you run off the end of that, you run into some critical variables. So all you had to do was, what they store down there is the pointers to the AES MMIO registers. So you just have to change those pointers to a register on the stack, and then, you know, when it pops the LR off the stack, you can jump right into the code. And then you have like 10 bytes to copy it back to the right place, and then you can run it. So yeah, that was for the iPod Touch 2, and then the 3DS comes out. And this is where I started running C. iBoot environment heap overflow. There was an overflow, there's heap overflow in the environment variables in iBoot. If you like in a bash shell, you can expand the environment variables by putting the dollar sign and then the name of the environment variable. What was checked in the length that it copied was the length of like dollar sign A. So that counted as 2, but if dollar sign A expanded to 50 characters, it only counted as 2 in the register. So you could overflow the heap, and the dev team and I both found this exploit independently. Their implementation actually exploited the malextruct. I just exploited the ring buffer that followed. When you have a ring buffer, ring buffers are great. You have a pointer to previous and a pointer to next. And when you remove something from a ring buffer, you store next and previous and previous and next. And that's a great way to get a one-byte switch. And with a one-byte switch, you can pretty much control any system. The Black Rain exploit is, there's a mem copy. So there's a USB control message you can send to it to read out data. But if you send the right version of that control message, as opposed to read, it does a mem copy to a null pointer. Which, you know, in most reasonable computer systems would just crash it. But in the iPhone, they put the exception vectors at address 0. So the IRQ vector is there. Send the IRQ vector to wherever you want, and then you got this code execution. What's really cool about that exploit, too, is the client-side part of Black Rain does no fingerprinting. It doesn't fingerprint the phone. It doesn't care which phone is running. It was possible to make the shell code, the payload, generic enough that it didn't matter which phone it was running on. It could do all the detection in real time. There's also, and I've hinted to this a couple times, an unreleased exploit in every iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch in the boot ROM to get code execution. And you know, if I ever do another jailbreak, that's the exploit I have. If you've seen, I posted like a picture of 4.0 jailbroken. I posted my iPad jailbroken all before Spirit was released. And I used a like completely different set of exploits, which maybe when iPhone 4 comes out, will be out. So another thing they added in the 3GS was no downgrade. You can't downgrade your phone. You know, you upgrade to 3.13 and you can't downgrade to 3.12. So the way they do this is they have the code, and the code is signed, and they added one more field. ECID, which is an ID that's unique to the processor on your iPhone. But they didn't realize that if you stored that signed thing, you could just copy it back over. Heard of a replay attack. All you need to do is replay it, and that's what Sorek's signing server does, if anybody's used that. You can, it goes to Apple's website and fetches all the unique keys for your phone, and then you can restore, instead of pointing to gs.apple.com, gs.sorek.com, or whatever. This is the iPhone baseband. The first one was the fake blank exploit, which it checked a couple of registers. It checked a couple of addresses in Flash, and if the addresses read FFFF, it would let you run your own payload. So the way I did this was I erased the top part of the Flash, and what the hardware exploit actually did was pull an address line high. So when it thought it was reading from address, let's say, like 14, it was actually reading from address 10,014, which is funny. The RSA exploit, which I talked about earlier, the Black and Viper, various stack buffer overflows and all the different commands, STK prop, I forget the next one. And then the heap overflow, which Black Snow uses, if any of you have 5.11.107 unlocked using that exploit. So theoretical about embedded security. What works, what doesn't? Look at the inputs and the outputs of the system. If you have a program, well, first of all, long programs are bad, shorter programs are better. The shorter a program is, the less lines of code there are, the less room there is for exploits. But it's not only that. It's the longer, you can have a 10 megabyte program that calculates whether a number is prime or not, like a large number. But because the inputs and outputs are just a number and a boolean, there's no room for fuzzing, sort of. And what makes things exploitable is when there's room to mess with the protocol. This happens when people make things generic. And, you know, lolotif. TIFF is included in the PSP, is included in the iPhone, and I have no idea why. Like, who's actually used a TIFF image? But it's included, and, you know, it's great, you know. Jailbreakme.com, the original PSP stuff, the new PSP stuff, it's all TIFF. Fascinating to be included. All right, let's get to the PlayStation 3 stuff. Only unhacked console, the seventh generation. The Wii, they don't have any security between the drive and the console, so that's how things like WiiKey Fusion work. The Xbox 360, well, there's just the plain old drive hack, which you modify the code running on your drive to tell it that burned DVDs are actually real DVDs. That doesn't allow homebrew, but then the JTAG hack came along, and because that happens all at the ROM level, I believe they can never patch it. I don't know that much about the Xbox, so don't quote me on that. Other OS, the PlayStation allows you to run Linux, which the other consoles, the PS2 allowed you to do it, but the other consoles don't let you do it. The cell processing. So IBM and Sony spent, I think, $400 million to develop this cell processor, and they hired security experts to come in and, you know, really design something secure. Well, they made some mistakes. So security is well done. Everything on both the Xbox 360 and the PS3 run underneath the hypervisor. And the hypervisor is not written by Sony. It's written by IBM. And you know IBM, they probably have a 700-page manual somewhere describing the very detailed functionality of that hypervisor, how to code it securely. And even now, with binary dumps, I still haven't been able to find any exploits in it, and I looked a little bit. So I spent 3 weeks when I lived in Cambridge exploring the hypervisor from a pure software perspective. Just, you have 255 syscalls, hypercalls, whatever you want to call it for a hypervisor. So just try it out, fuzzing the inputs. And what I was really looking for there was just a memory leak. Some way I could leak back information from the hypervisor's memory space, dump the hypervisor, and then find a better exploit, which would let me write to memory or execute code. So when I say security is well done, let me see what it's saying. Okay. So when I say security is well done, the boot chain, unlike the iPhone's boot chain, is non-linear. It doesn't proceed in a linear fashion. I mean, on the iPhone's boot chain, the second you own any piece of code, you own the rest of the boot chain. On the PS3, this is true, but it's not apparent right away why. But, so this is their security model. They have a ROM, which loads a binary off the NAND flash, called a secure loader. And all this stuff is encrypted. Everything's encrypted on the PS3. A secure loader, which runs on the on an SPU, boot ROM. So yeah, the cell architecture is you have the PPU, which is a power PC core, and then you have eight of these SPUs, synergistic processing units. And all these companies, they try to find something in between a GPU and a CPU, and every one of them has failed horribly. But so yeah, these SPUs, they're used for security. So it loads a secure loader, and a secure loader does the decryption on the SPU for LV0. LV0 is like the bootloader, which sets up things like the hard drive encryption, sets the stage for Metloader runs right. Okay, so on the SPU, there's the IBM secure interface and the Sony secure interface. And Sony wrote this little interface thing called Metloader, which we believe stands for Metaloader, which you load into an SPU. And then Metloader can load the other loaders, LV1 loader, LV2 loader, ISO loader, app loader, onto that same SPU. So it reads off the encrypted NAND flash, decrypts it all in the SPU's memory space. Now the SPU has memory on the cell's die, which means there's no way to set it. Well, without crazy equipment. But so yeah, it loads, Metloader loads LV1 loader, which loads LV1. LV1 is the hypervisor. And then LV1, okay, so LV1 has the hypervisor code, and it also has a stripped down, I believe it's an AIX kernel. It actually runs a complete kernel and has these three processes which it runs. And one process is in charge of talking with the system controller, one process is in charge of doing things like booting into other OS, and the last one is in charge of booting the PS3's kernel. And they export this these RPC calls through an interface called IF Proto. So there's like RPC calls you can make from the PS3 kernel to this other kernel that's running in a different virtual partition of the hypervisor. Partition 0, the PS3 kernel, or the other OS kernel runs in partition 2. So yeah, LV2 is the kernel, and then LV2 loads Metloader as well, which loads AppLoader, which loads PS3 applications or games or whatever. So PS3 exploit. There isn't one. At least that I know. So, well, if there is, I'm not clever enough to find it. So, inputs and outputs. Look at the system. What does it export? The RAM chips are just sitting right there. All I need to do is find something where it thinks it wrote to the RAM, but it didn't write to the RAM, and that's what the exploit is. Let's see what else. Okay, coding assumptions. Here's some C code. Volatile int I equals 1 was volatile. It always writes back to the actual memory. I++ print I. Well, clearly this is 2, right? And any reasonable programmer would believe this. Single threaded and cacheless. What does it do? It writes I equals 1. It reads I. It writes I equals 2. And it reads I again. Well, what if while it's writing I equals 2, I remove the memory from the system? Pull the memory chip out, put it back in. It thinks it wrote I equals 2. The code that wrote I equals 2 executed, the processor instruction pointer is past that point, but I never got set to 2. So that's a assumption the programmer makes. It's a completely reasonable assumption, and all I have to do is violate it. So the PS3 has a PPC core. PPC has hashed page tables, which is sort of like a page table in reverse. You have an address, it runs a hash function over it, and then it looks it up in this hash page table, and that actually points to the memory that's mapped there. So the hypervisor allows you to allocate memory, it allows you to map memory, and it allows you to deallocate memory. So I allocate some memory, I map it all over the page table, and then I deallocate it. Now the hypervisor knows when memory is deallocated, it has to remove all the entries pointing to that memory from the page table. But, well, I glitched the memory. It thinks it removed the entries, it didn't. So go ahead, encrypt and add ECC to your memory. You know, spend tons of money. Microsoft loves to do this. Spend some money. Doesn't matter. I mean, the idea is that the write back missed. So you have a cache on the processor which caches all writes. And then when the cache actually goes to write back and remain coherent with the memory, that's when I glitched the memory. It thinks it wrote it. It didn't. So from this exploit, you actually have full control over the PS3. So, there's SPUs and there's a secure mode in which it loads the SPU binaries, but it all doesn't matter because the PPU is the master controller. It can tell the SPUs don't load, it can tell them to load, and the highest privilege level of execution is hypervisor. There's hypervisor, kernel, and user. It's three. x86 is like it's the equivalent of ring 0, ring 1, all the way down to, I think it's ring 3. Then they have ring negative, one of those virtualization things, like VMware and stuff. But so you have hypervisor mode, and I can get code execution from this in hypervisor mode. I mean, so what the rest of the exploit actually is, once you have access in the page table to a piece of memory that you're not supposed to have access to, you can allocate a virtual memory space that has the page table, has the virtual memory space's page table in the area that you have access to that the hypervisor doesn't believe you have access to. So you can rewrite to a page table, I map the whole hypervisor section, I switch into that virtual memory space, and then I have the entire memory mapped, including the real page table from the original memory space. I map everything there, then I switch back. And what I found was the easiest way to export this interface back to kernel land was I added two more hypercalls, peek and poke. And if you ever played with the Apple II computer, these were the original ways to, you could peek and poke any address. So you can do the same thing on the PS3 with the after the exploit is run. A whole new world, No one has looked at this stuff outside Sony. No one's seen this code. So yeah, the first thing I did was I jumped the entire RAM. The hypervisor lives there. And unbeknownst to me, this whole other kernel, these little three applications that run, which by the way, look in the hypervisor bumps, that's not garbage. Here's a big hint about the PS3, that stuff's not garbage. There's a page table there, reconstruct it. So nobody's seen this code outside Sony yet, it's in 33.5 million people's houses. So I was like a kid in a candy store going through all this stuff, it's really cool. Crypto engines. The iPhone has a crypto engine. PSP has a crypto engine. It's called like Kirk or Spock or something. Maybe all Star Trek characters. So what these things are decryption oracles. Just because you can't get the key itself out of the embedded system, the system has to have a way to decrypt things. So here you go. Here's an application I want decrypted. Give it to the oracle. The oracle decrypts it and gives you back the decrypted version. So like the AES engine in the iPhone is an example of this. You go, here's some memory, I want to decrypt it. And still to this day, nobody knows the AES key of the iPhone. Nobody knows what the actual AES key of the iPhone is, so it always has to be run on device. By the way, when you see those like, the keys for 4.0 GM released, what they did was run the AES engine on that device. So you can't get it, but you can use it. All crypto on the PS3 is done in these isolated SPUs. And these SPUs go into isolation mode. They have hex 40,000 of local storage, which is on-die memory for each one of these SPUs. But the PPU is the one in charge. The SPUs really have no ability to do anything. So really, they're oracles. This $400 million security scheme is no better than the security scheme that's been used for years and years and years on every secure processor. There's so much potential here for good security. Put one SPU in charge, it's always signature checking the memory. Worst case, have a flag. Well, actually, I think I talk about this in the next slide. But so much potential here to do this right, and we already did it. The flaw. I can use the oracles. Not only, so the oracles are these things like AppLoader and LV2 Loader, which let you decrypt the kernel and let you decrypt the applications. Not only can I use them, but I don't even need the exploit. And this is, Sony probably knows this, and this might be part of the reason Otteros is gone. You can just load MetLoader. MetLoader is that initial loader. The register, which allows the SPUs to run in isolation mode, is not hypervisor privileged. It's kernel privileged. So the Linux kernel can just poke to this register. You can load MetLoader, which is all encrypted and secure, but you load it into the SPU. Just because I can't see the code that's running, I can use it. So one annoying thing is that MetLoader is system unique. So if there's a MetLoader floating around the internet, everybody can't use the same MetLoader on their PS3. It's encrypted with like a UID AES key or something. What they didn't do here was assume their system was going to be compromised. They didn't assume that anybody would even be able to get to MetLoader or figure out how to use it. All you have to do to get MetLoader, open up your PS3, desolder the NAND flash. There are 48 TSOP chips, the most simple NAND flash to read. Lift it out, read the chip, you get your MetLoader off there, put it back together, boot it in Otteros, and if you figure out how to do it, you can load MetLoader, you can load Level 2 Loader, you can decrypt kernels, you can load AppLoader, you can decrypt games. So the way this could have been alleviated is if after the Otteros, when it was commanded to load the Otteros kernel, map out the isolation mode. There's no reason in Otteros kernel you need to ever have this isolation mode, so they should have had a write once register to map it out, but they didn't do it. Good for us. So, that's pretty much my talk. I actually have no idea what time it is and what time my talk is supposed to end, but if you guys have any questions, I'll try my best to answer them. I hope a lot of my talk came across. I get excited about this stuff and I talk fast. So, any questions? Well, there's definitely still stuff to do. I don't doubt there's stuff to do. Hi, I use Black Rain. It didn't work. Please help. Oh. Well, I go to the website. I donate money. I click download link. It downloads. But it didn't work. What now? Or I'm on iPhone. I go to blackrain.com, but it doesn't jailbreak my phone. So, this is what I deal with every day. So, when I started with the PS3, I was like, I don't want this thing to be like an iPhone suit. I'm not going to release, I'm not Dark Alex. I'm not going to release a nice, easy custom firmware that everyone can restore to. I broke the system on a cool, theoretical level. And, someone can step up and figure the rest out. From a theoretical level, the PS3 is broken. Is broken enough to run Homebrew, is broken enough to run the current Blu-rays, is broken enough to run anything. It's just a matter of working out how the boot chain works, figuring out how to run the next part of the boot chain, figuring out a way around the isolated SPUs, which, because the PPUs are charged, check this out. The isolated SPUs, just because you can't, you see you can run them. And you can run them with the MMU enabled, which means even if like the level 2 loader thought it was integrity checking the hypervisor, I could just set up a fake memory with a fake hypervisor that's intact. And because the SPUs are allowed to run with the MMU enabled, I thought it was really the first one. I've been messing with this stuff for a long time. I have sort of a background. I did science fair when I was in high school, so I sort of have a background in electronics. I did a lot of microprocessors and FPGAs. And then, so you know, even before that, I did a lot of mechanical stuff too, like mechanical engineering. And then I did more electrical engineering, now I do software engineering. The real reason for that is a 6-pound computer is a lot lighter than, you know, a soldering iron and wire, and carrying everything you need out for that, which is a lot lighter than everything you need for a mechanical engineer. So, I'm going to be dead at such a little bit. Actually, I shouldn't say that, that's a little, yeah, the V710. It was a phone released by Verizon where they crippled the Bluetooth. The phone supported OBAS, for file exchange. But Verizon crippled it, so you go to the Verizon store and buy $1.50 wallpaper and MP3s. So yeah, that was the first thing I really tried with. I didn't know about back then. The iPhone was the first thing I actually put into the Apple. Which phone would I advise you to use for the best security? Not the iPhone. I'll tell you that much. It's actually a really problem. And like, the world hasn't really seen it yet. Things like mobile phone viruses, and like, computer viruses. No, okay, it's called computer viruses. But a mobile phone virus has the potential to monetize right away. And it's scary when people visit the site. So for the best security, I'm not going to recommend a phone, I'm not going to keep a couple of business, but maybe BlackBerry. I think green stuff is mostly for the same thing. No, I don't know that much. You saw the SMS hack back in. By the way, when I first read about the SMS, remember the SQL Slammer virus? SQL, it would infect and right away send tons more. It basically shut down the internet for an hour. Imagine an SMS slammer virus. SMS, infect this phone, SMS ID loss. Not that I do any of this stuff. But theoretically, it's scary. It really is. Like, how much we depend on the mobile phone network, too. Best for security? Is Linux better than Windows for security? I know most people would say yes, but there's advantages to play source, advantages to open source. I think it's a personal choice. It's the company you trust the most. Personally? Oh, Windows. Windows is very nice. And here's the reason why. My server, my file server is Linux, my web server is Linux, but when it comes to day-to-day, like browsing the web, my theory is that the video card drive is much better. Like, so think of like NVIDIA. They have to have a team of like 200 people, 300 people working on their driver for Windows, and they have like two interns working on the driver for Linux. So I don't know, Windows just feels fast. That's why I use it as a personal operating system. This presentation I actually did in Keynote. I have a MacBook which I use as a laptop. MacBook, know, that's an interesting question. Because code bases are definitely growing. There's more and more and more code. I mean, you think about how much code was on a phone 10 years ago versus how many lines of code on a phone. Look at the Linux code. The difference between the number of lines of code back then and the number of lines of code now. But at the same time, we are moving away from C. I mean, Android, Java. And as you get away from the lower level languages, if you don't have to deal with memory management, the odds of a buffer overflow happening are, I mean, sure, if there's an overflow in your JVM, then you got a problem. But you build the security based on a small trusted code base, then you can have untrusted code running up here. I mean, just because that doesn't allow full compromise of the system for doing things like dumping people's SMS database, all you need to do is compromise stuff at a high level. But there are no more like, so I would say it's getting hard, as a general rule. Even though code bases are getting bigger, things are moving more toward virtualization. I love the approach Chrome took to JavaScript, if you looked at the V8 engine at all. Brand new engine, how are there no like exploits? Because they wrote very little in native. They wrote a lot of JavaScript in JavaScript. And once it's in JavaScript, it's only the barrier, like the privilege barrier that has to be trusted. Once you're here, it can be untrusted. So, good to think. So that's that. There's got to be more questions. Anything? Am I what? Am I contacting Sony or Apple? No, I don't think I'd do that. But have I been contacted by Sony or Apple? Well, no, never have. I think it's a PR policy thing, you know, if we're not going to sue them, we're not going to contact them. What are they really going to say? Hi, I'm Steve Jobs. I won't admit it publicly, but jailbreaking has raised iPhone sales. And I haven't upgraded my personal phone to 3.13. By the way, there's a picture out there of Steve Jobs' iPhone on 3.12. So. But, no, I've never been contacted. Biggest challenge on breaking the PS3. It was sort of I spent 3 weeks doing it completely from a software perspective because I didn't have like nice things like oscilloscopes and FPGAs at my house in Cambridge. It's a very sophisticated exploit. Like look at the code, and I code entirely messy. XY Loser from the PS3 scene took my code and and it looks a lot nicer. But yeah, writing that piece of code, I mean, everything with the PS3 was sort of just like grueling and going through it. Like, I was like, I think this is gonna work, it's just a matter of implementing it. There wasn't like one like major breakthrough I had with the PS3. It wasn't like the 1661 where like dumping the boot ROM was sophisticated and cool. It was just, you know, going through the motions, all right. Okay, so I have to make another virtual address space or else read the hypervisor docs, figure out how to do it. But the hardest part, probably opening it up and soldering to a little point. Xilinx. Xilinx FPGAs are about, last time I checked, about 10 times better than the competition price for game wise. Code with FPGAs is very annoying because the synthesized times, there's no incremental device. The trying it doesn't work yet. So you gotta like, oh, look, I did a big project for Google with FPGAs. And I had this big code base, and by the end of the time, it was taking 30 minutes to synthesize. Okay, I made my changes, synthesize, go out to dinner. Xilinx. Questions? Anything? Do I think people have a use for the level 1 stuff? With an unmodified console, what do you mean, can it be used for?
Oh,
people... Of course. It's been leaked, the hypervisor for the PS3, you know, go home, open it up in IDA, it's PPC. It's pretty easy to find a syscall table. You see the syscalls, maybe there's something I overlooked. Maybe there's a software accident. The question was, do I think I'd be able to do this without the hardware I have? The iPhone is also awesome. I mean, I don't like dealing with hardware. When I don't have to deal with hardware, I don't. If you can do it all with software. When I first came into the city, I did do a lot more with hardware because it's the background I'm familiar with. But now, to have to open it up is a big hassle. Like, even getting a serial port on the right, I'm just like a little, but still, you know, I have to solder it up. I have to get a Max 232 chair. Hook it up to the USB to serial and plug it all in. If you can do it all through software, all the time. But yeah, so the PS3, no, I don't think I would have gotten out that hard. The question was, did I learn everything I know by myself? Obviously not. The internet? So most of what I learned from, reading the internet. Cool, this guy's doing this with routers, this guy's doing this with cable modems. I just started to, for a long time before this stuff, I followed in the footsteps of others. Like all the, like the router hacks and the, TCL/ISO, uncatch your cable modem hacks, and I modded my Xbox and back in 8th grade. I didn't know how this stuff worked. Cool, I could buy a mod chip, I could download games. Seriously, XBMC was it was cool. I could do this. I didn't understand how this stuff worked so much later. But, I learned it by watching. I figured the same way, weren't really like formal. I didn't care about spooky stuff. I figured most of the people that hear it were just by reading the internet. That's cool. I wasn't going to do that myself. Oh, did I use any knowledge from courses, the theoretical stuff? Did I use any of the knowledge from the courses I went to? No. Really, I've never used calculus in my life. I mean, I used it in class to pass the test, and then after that, it's sort of a difference between theoretical and practical. And I mean, the theoretical background is nice to have, but it's not like, theoretically, this should be this. Let me do this big double integral and, I can hack it by doing that. No, just try it. I code like that too. Like, that's my coding style. I spam code. I don't really think too much about it. I just, okay.